Napa know-how.
It takes a lot to get excited about a bag, but most bags can't save you 20% on auto parts. That's 20% off headlamps, 20% off oil filters, 20% off virtually anything you can fit inside the 99-cent Napa reusable bag. So tell your buddies, there's a bag they just have to check out. Quality parts, helpful people. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.
At participating Napa Auto Parts stores while supplies last. Minimum three items. Exclusions apply. Offer ends 10/31/17.
All right, welcome to a special episode of Locked On Bulls and the Locked On Podcast Network. As always, you can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Audioboom, TuneIn, Google Play, anywhere else you can find podcasts. Make sure you subscribe, leave us a review, tell your friends to subscribe. You can find us on Twitter at Locked On Bulls, like us on Facebook at Locked On Bulls. We have a very special interview to bring you with Sam Smith, a legendary writer for Bulls.com, formerly the Tribune, author of the Jordan Rules. We figured with Jerry Krause, the former GM of the Bulls, passing away yesterday, we've been getting a lot of requests over the last few months to have Sam on. We figured now would be as good of a time as any to do it, and it was fantastic. It went for almost an hour. He was just telling stories about Jerry Krause and about the Jordan era, and it's really worth your time. Just real quick, we want to hit on tonight, the Bulls beat the Pistons at home.
They did, 117-95. Niko Mirotić had a season-high 28 points. Jimmy Butler, 16 points, 12 assists, 6 hockey assists, according to Fred Hoiberg. So Jimmy did a good job orchestrating the offense. I think we've talked a lot about Bulls basketball, gymnastics, storylines, strategy, X's and O's, so we're not going to get much into that, but just a update, they're a game and a half back of the final playoff spot now. The Bulls are of the Heat. They are now tied with the Pistons, essentially, in ninth place. The Bulls will have the tiebreaker now against the Pistons, should they finish with identical records, because they clinched a better division record than the Pistons after splitting the season series 2-2. Jimmy Butler fell on his wrist after finishing an alley-oop dunk. He shook it a lot, stayed in the game, did fine. He said he's from Tomball, Texas. Robin Lopez served his one-game suspension. Chris Felicio did not play because of a bruised bone in his back or something along those
lower
lines.
Back bruise is what we were
lower
told.
Back bruise, and the hope for the Bulls is that he can return Friday night against the 76ers, which is their next game. That's uncertain, though, so it'll probably be a game-time decision for Chris Felicio. But like we said before, please do thoroughly enjoy the interview with Sam Smith, which was absolutely great, and keep it locked on Bulls.
All right, well, we have a very special guest here with us. We've gotten a lot of Twitter requests over the last few months or so to have him have this guy on.
Two.
There's been a couple, but
at least three.
At least three. We want, we hate that it's under these circumstances, but, you know, with the passing of Jerry Krause yesterday, we figured now is as good of a time as any to bring on Sam Smith, writer for Bulls.com currently, covered the team for the Tribune for many years during the whole Jordan championship run, is the author of The Jordan Rules, which is one of the most important basketball books of all time.
How many years did you cover the Bulls for the Tribune, Sam, and how did that overlap with Jerry Krause's tenure?
George Kohler, Jordan's driver, and I share the distinction of the only people to be at Michael Jordan's three first games and three last games.
Really?
So we were there in 84 at his first game against Washington, and 93 at his last game in the game six when he got on the airplane after the Bulls blew game five. If you guys remember that, you guys probably weren't born yet.
We were little. We were very little.
We were very little. That was the famous game where Chicago was coming home to win the championship against Phoenix, and the mayor and various people put out warnings on TV that day because there had been sort of a riot of sorts in 92 when they won at home in 92 and Michigan Avenue was shut down, and you literally couldn't get from here to downtown from the Chicago Stadium then, but the same place where United, across the street from United Center. So the next year when they go up 3-1, they won their first two it was a great series, first two in Phoenix, and had this triple overtime game, and so they get to game, they're up 3-1, and there's announcements on TV, the please don't destroy the city, you know, please behave, and so the Suns sort of, you know, took advantage of that and all came to the game. I remember Barkley coming to the game saying, we're here to save Chicago by winning this game. And they do. They win the game. They win game five. And tremendous disappointment. So the next morning, the team was flying to Phoenix. The next morning, Jordan walks onto the, I guess it was the plane. He's got a big, long cigar and walks in and says, welcome, the world champions. And they go, Phoenix win game six on Paxson's crazy shot. And three-peat, as it were.
Do you think Jordan golfed that day? Did he golf that day, too?
You know, we got there. It was, and I love Phoenix. I've actually got a place, a house there. It was one of the hottest days ever. We got there. Really? It was like 115 or 116 or something. It was extraordinary. Now, I wouldn't put it past him, but I don't think he played golf that day. He would do that more in South Florida when the Bulls were playing Miami. But I'm not even quite got to your answer yet. So, George, that was George. So, 93. Then we were both at 95 and 98, mm-hmm. the last game in Utah. And then, first game in Washington and the last game in Washington. And when the last one in Washington was against Philadelphia. And so, George and I, and you don't get anything from that, it turns out, even though I was at all those games with George. So, but that's a long answer for. I started covering the beat full time in 87, but like in the early 80s, in 84, when Jordan came, I was sort of doing the backup on the beat. And before that, I was doing a lot of sports features. I went, that's where I met Phil Jackson. I did a week in the CBA and went to Albany and in like 81 or 82 when Phil was coaching the Albany Patroons.
What led you to do a feature story on Phil in the CBA before
it was actually
his Bulls tenure, really?
Yeah, it was actually a CBA story, and there was a guy named Carl Nix. Carl was from Hammond or Gary, and Chicago guy. He was Larry Bird's teammate at Indiana State, on the Indiana State team that played Magic's team, the famous Final Four game, championship game. Yeah. Carl was a starting point guard for that team, and then he was in the CBA, which was sort of a version of the D League. You know, better than the D League now, but you know, it was a pretty high level basketball league because there were 22 or something NBA teams, so there were a lot more talent to go in the D League in the minor league than CBA. So I was going to do a story on Carl, and so I went and it's not glamorous if you go in the D-League now or you go in the
right.
C. So we
They took, still fly commercial even today in the D-League.
Yeah, well, we did. We took a bus from here to Albany, New York, which is a long bus ride. Or it was a van. We had a little van.
I imagine.
And so then we got there hanging around Albany. So I went to the games and then met Phil. And then I knew Phil. I didn't know him, but I'd watched him as a Nick. I grew up in New York. And I knew him as a player, and I knew his story. So I went and spent some time with him, and Charlie Rosen was his assistant then.
Yeah.
And got to know him. And then when I came back to Chicago and was doing basketball features, I would always call Phil, you know, sort of his quirky, you know, knowledge about the game. I remember doing a story about, sort of a feature in basketball about, sort of the baseball version of, what do you call it, the little tricks of the trade. Yeah. What's the word for it? Were, you know, hidden ball tricks or whatever.
And yeah.
So Phil would become one of my experts about the NBA when I would call around. So I was kind of doing sports at the Tribune since like 82, and then did the Bulls full-time from like 87 on, and then NBA too.
No,
did you ever run across Jerry Krause before he got, because he became the GM of the Bulls full time in 85.
Yeah.
But before that, you know, he had been a scout for the Bulls and a scout for the White Sox, and you were kind of doing features all over the place. Did you ever run across him before he was actually the GM of the team?
I hadn't run across him before Jerry Reinsdorf hired him, but Krause has a really interesting history in Chicago, you know, with the Bulls.
He's from the area, yeah.
Not before, but, you know, he worked for the Bulls. He was the personnel director. And there were, there were some great stories that he came back. He actually went to work for the old Chicago Zephyrs.
Right.
The Packers Zephyrs. And then they moved to Baltimore, became the Bullets. And then he came back, you know, still as a scout, sort of gopher, whatever, in the Bulls in the late 60s. And then you know, that there was really no scouting staffs to talk about. You know, nobody went out and scouted games. They read sport magazines and they did the draft off those things like that. So, you know, so Jerry was just trying to carve out a, you know, a sort of a career. And then Dick Motta kind of takes over the team and was, you know, an emperor, you know, a little dictator, really, what they call them. Players hated Dick, and Dick hated Jerry. And there were two great stories. So Jerry, I forget the year of the draft, but Jerry is their scout. He's going out there when they're scouting for the Bulls. And so he focuses on Jimmy Collins, and that's who he's recommended. He wants the Bulls to pick Jimmy Collins, who went on to become the coach at UIC, whatever they call it now. And so the Bulls pick Jimmy Collins, and they pass on Tiny Archibald. So everywhere the Bulls go after that, Motta, whenever Jerry's around, introduces Jerry to say, I want you to meet Jerry Krause. He's the guy who convinced me not to take Tiny Archibald.
And then he's saying this jokingly and
he tells everybody.
Half jokingly.
Yeah, not very
and
jokingly.
Mad too. Motta didn't, he's more mad than anything.
Motta's pissed. Motta was furious, pissed off at Jerry, and just killing him all the time. But Jerry sort of got his revenge. So Jerry recommends them and is influential in them getting Cliff Ray. Clifford Ray. Who it turns out they end up trading to Golden State in 74 for Nate Thurmond, who they thought Motta was always screaming, we gotta have a center, because we can't and true, they get knocked up by only Kareem and Wilt in all those years, and they were in the Western Conference. So we need a center to match Kareem and Wilt, and they finally trade for Nate Thurmond, and they trade Cliff to Golden State, who becomes key in beating them in the conference finals and keeping them probably from a championship, as Golden State then goes on the sweep. You know, they're up 3-2 in that championship. But the other one was, so Motta is done with Jerry after, even though Jerry's still on the staff, he's done with Jerry after the Tiny Archibald thing. So he now decides he's going to go out and scout. And he goes out. Howard Porter, if you remember him, has this great NCAA tournament from Villanova. He was most outstanding player. I think Villanova was runner-up in the national championships, and he averages like 30. Has this great tournament, and Motta says, I've never seen a player just as good. And Jerry recommends, he said, don't pick this guy. He's not pro-level player. Anyway, the Bulls give Porter the biggest contract in franchise history, and he's a complete bust. Can't even get into the couldn't get into the rotation like ever. And I know in his first year didn't. And so it's a disaster. But then Jerry gets caught up. One of Jerry's flaws, biggest flaws, and it's understandable for who you are. He grew up to be a scout, you know, which is a solitary, sort of lonely existence.
Right.
And so he's not somebody who learns, you know, how to be political, how to sort of be social. There's no sort of school for that. And that's not who he was. He's not comfortable with. So he gets caught up in Motta's being fired because he's kind of destroyed the team. I mean, this is sort of off base, but it's the most extraordinary post-game in the history of the NBA.
Okay.
The Bulls, that's the season, 75. They're up 3-2 on Golden State in the conference finals. They lose here in Chicago, which is the big game six, known then as the Mother's Day Massacre. It was Mother's Day. Bulls lose, have to go out to Golden State. They're leading and blow it down the stretch and lose game seven. Golden State goes on and wins the title in a sweep over Washington. After the game, the players gather in the locker room, and Motta comes in and he tells the team, he tells all the players to deny post-game shares to Norm Van Leer and Bob Love because they both hold out at the beginning of the season. And if they, he says, tells the team, if they hadn't held out, we'd have won because we'd have home court advantage. So it's their fault we lost this series.
Wow. Oh.
And you guys, not only is it their fault we lost this series, but you guys should not give them any playoff money. So the team goes, it's a complete revolution.
Did they agree to do it, or were they?
No, of course not. They completely turn on
the team's coach.
Right. It was a complete mutiny after that. The team just completely explodes. There's never been a post game like that ever. And the next season, they win like 22 games, and Motta is fired. And so then Jerry's still there. So Jerry gets caught up in somebody, they suggest to Jerry. And now the NBA is not big then. You know, the NBA, this is 1976. college basketball.
Still the tape delay
bigger.
Years.
It was tape delay into the early 80s. And it wasn't just that 79, that 80 series when Magic had the big game six. It was like 81 and 82 still they were doing tape delays. And so Jerry gets told to go try and hire Ray Meyer to be the Bulls coach. And so Jerry does. But this
got a DePaul tie, right?
Yeah.
He's at DePaul.
Ray's coaching DePaul.
Yeah. Which back then was a big time program.
Big,
DePaul,
right.
So
right.
This would be a big hire.
Right. It would be huge. Yeah, it'd be a huge coup. And so Jerry goes to Ray, you know, and supposedly Ray accepts it. And anyway, DePaul, I'm not a religious person, so I don't know what they are. Jesuits, whatever. What are they over there? You know, the priests. They get furious at the Bulls.
They're the blue demons now, right?
I don't know what they are.
Which is
so they get furious with the Bulls, and you know, because they're trying to steal Meyer from them. So they go to the Bulls ownership and, you know, and threaten them. They say, you know, we're going to run you out of town, you know, because they're much bigger than the NBA, and the Bulls are barely surviving back then. I mean, they almost move again in '74 to San Diego. You know, so they're sort of on life support still, and so they hang out Jerry about this, and Bulls say, well, we never asked him to go ask the Ray Meyer because the Paul people were so upset, and they just hang him out there and he gets fired.
Then he shifts after basketball into baseball a little bit before he goes back.
He goes
to the Bulls in 85.
He goes back to baseball. Well, he came back to the Bulls, he came back to the White Sox first.
Yeah.
Bill Beck hires him. And he knew Beck knew him, you know, and knew he was a good scout. And so Beck hires him, and when...
Because Jerry Reinsdorf ended up hiring Jerry Krause, even though he didn't know him well, right? It was
right.
Kind of off advice.
He was
just like, I've heard this guy is smart about basketball, so, you know, that's what I'm
I'll tell you that story if you want to know that story.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
So Beck hires Krause, and Krause is working, you know, as a low-level scout, you know, going out. And that's what he loves. He loves doing that. He wasn't necessarily looking for anything, and what the problem Jerry had with you know, media or public or recognition, whatever, was that it's sort of the nature of the job and the nature of who he was. He's a private person, because not just private, a lot of people are private, but scouting is a solitary life, like, you know, I was saying. And if you're going to run a team, it's a public position. You got to be the face of the organization, especially back then. You know, now they've got like layers in there and there's assistants and associates and all that stuff. And then it wasn't, you know, just he was like the GM and the coach, you know. They didn't have six guys sitting behind the bench. The coach had his drinking buddy to go out with, and the GM was the GM. That was the whole staff. So, you know, and there's no school to learn it. You know, it's not like you go to law school, accounting, you get a degree. There's no program to be a GM.
Right.
So anyway, Jerry's working, you know, Reinsdorf inherits Krause, inherits the White Sox staff, and, you know, Jerry's just a scout. He's just another scout, you know. And so when they buy the team, Reinsdorf buys the team, and he doesn't really know anybody in the NBA. And so Krause sends him a letter saying, I'd like to run the Bulls. And you know, I was Bulls personnel director in the 75, 76, whatever, and I have a plan for building a champion. So Reinsdorf says, well, who is this guy? He asks somebody, you know, one of the other White Sox guys who were there, he says, who is this guy? You know, he doesn't even, you know who he is. So he tells him who he is, and he said, and Reinsdorf says, you mean that guy who never shuts up in the scouting meetings?
Always getting his opinion out there.
Right, because Jerry, you know, the thing about Jerry was he was somebody who would emphasize. If he told you something about somebody that they could do something one time, he'd tell you 30 times. And over, and that's just his sort of nature,
right?
He did things, he talked. And so it's like, and that was that's how he did the trade with Ozzie Guillen for Lamar Hoyt. Because Jerry never shut up in the meetings, talking about Ozzie Guillen's this, Ozzie Guillen's that, Ozzie Guillen's that. And just talked him into it finally. And so Reinsdorf says he'll meet with him. And Jerry comes up to meet with him, and he lays out this plan about defense and team play and building from, you know, and it sort of sounds to Jerry, who's not a basketball guy, sounds to Jerry like the Knicks, you know, the sort of the way they built. That was his team growing up, you know, in New York. Move the ball, five guys on the court who can all shoot, you know, play defense, share, unselfish sort of thing. And he sort of outlines this whole thing. And sounds good to Ryan Zerbe. He doesn't know anybody else in basketball. So the one thing he does do, he goes to Bill Bradley. He'd met Bill Bradley. And he asks him, he said, you know, he's got this plan. And he says, what do you think about that, about a way to play basketball? And Bradley says, that's exactly what you should be doing. So he hires Krause. And that's how he ends up hiring Krause. And then they start this project of, you know, Jerry's thing was always two things. Now, he comes in, if you knew any of these people or looked back, and, you know, Jordan's talked about it. Now, they held out against Krause. They would say, well, he inherited Michael Jordan. But he inherited arguably the most dysfunctional roster in the league at the time.
He once told Adrian Wojnarowski on his podcast, his first thought, when looking at the Bulls roster, was Michael Jordan and 11 guys I don't want. Is that right. A fair way to put it, basically?
That's exactly what. Because Jerry's two, you know, sort of acronyms. One was OKP. He always talked about that. It's going to have
our
OKP
kind of people.
Our kind of people, yeah. And we're going to do addition by subtraction. Ooh. And that's how we're going to build a team. But everybody we get rid of is going to make us better. Because he literally had half dozen guys who ended up in drug rehab on that team. Quentin Daly, Enos Watley, Orlando Woolridge.
I've got the roster pulled up right here.
Quentin
Daly, Chris Angler, Sidney Green, Dave Greenwood. These are just
a lot of names.
Well, the amazing thing was these were all high. It wasn't a lottery then. These were high draft picks. If you looked at this, Quentin Daly was like a five. He had raped somebody in college, which didn't help him. And it didn't make the Bulls the only team in NBA history whose opener was picketed by a National Organization for Women. So that's not probably a good thing for your opener.
It's not great.
So the Quentin Daly pick. David Greenwood is the guy they were in the coin flip for Magic Johnson in 79. And Magic wants to come to Chicago because he wants to play with Horace Gilmore.
Oh.
And it's close to home.
Yeah.
And that's part of when he was leaving. You know, when the Bulls and the Lakers had the pick, the Lakers end up getting the pick from the from the trade. So the Bulls or the Lakers, back then they did a coin flip. And so Magic had known Artis Gilmore and he wanted to stay close to home. So he was more really at the time inclined, his agent had told me that he wanted to come to Chicago. And so the Bulls lose the coin flip. And they ended up instead of Magic Johnson, get David Greenwood.
So I want to. So much is made of Krause's his work ethic, being in the gyms, and just putting in all this time, and how much he appreciated the grind of it. But did he see scouting and talent evaluation in a different way than maybe people of his time, maybe anyone ever? And if so, like, how did that pertain to him acquiring Pippen or Horace Grant or all these guys the Bulls had in the future? Like, the way he saw the game, because he wasn't obviously a great athlete or a basketball player himself, but, like, how did he see it and how did that affect him and his decisions with the Bulls?
Yeah, I don't know if his scouting methods, it was eccentric in the way he did things. I don't know if his as far, because he learned from, you know, top people in the game. He was somebody who would try to get mentors and ask questions. He did so with Dean Smith. He did so a lot with Red Auerbach. And he tried to seek out knowledge from a lot of the, you know, top people in the business. I don't think he had some, you know, unique way of measuring talent more than somebody else, because he made his share of mistakes just like everybody else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody judges drafts in hindsight, and you can't do it because everybody's made the same amount of mistakes. It's hard to judge, not to say it was easier then. It's much harder now because he's, you know, the 18, 19 years old or something. At least there you saw him for a couple of years in college. You know, but Jerry's thing with the Bulls, what he was able to do, I think, was more actually as a GM, you know, which he doesn't get as much credit for as a scout. You know, he was more proud of being a scout, but his success was a GM, because he had heard about Scottie Pippen, but he hadn't really seen him very much.
Okay,
and he sent, Billy McKinney, I think it was.
Okay.
I think he sent Billy McKinney to see him. It was the
and then he wanted Billy to kind of stay quiet, not
Well, he was famous for that, right?
And this is back before, you know, every team had a million scouts who were scouting every corner. Like, people weren't, like, every team didn't have somebody scouting at Central Arkansas.
Right. Nobody had anyone scouting, essentially. Because Scotty ends up going to the, you know, that first, the preliminary camp, which is for, you know, second round or something.
Portsmouth.
Yeah.
And that's where he blew up. He goes to Portsmouth, and now, holy crap, look at this guy. He's, you know, with the length and the speed. Because Scotty was a point guard in high school, and then he grew like 8 inches or something, you know, his first year of college. Yeah. You know, Scotty's story is really one of the most remarkable. I mean, he came to college on a work-study program. And so as a freshman in college, he was the town kid in the locker room, handing out towels to the players.
Okay.
He wasn't good enough to be on the team at Central Arkansas when he was a freshman. He just wanted to be in college. He was you know, grew up in a house. He was like the 10th or 11th kid. You know, he was the last kid, but he was like, I don't know if it was 10 or 11, in a two-room place in this nowhere middle of Arkansas. And so, you know, just getting to college was going to... So, you know, so he just exploded. No one's even heard of him, you know, because he wasn't recruited. He wasn't, you know, he was nothing in high school. He was a point guard. He was like 6'2", and all of a sudden, you know, he's this 6'8", you know, gazelle. And so Barney Blake, who was sort of the scouting, that's the way scouting went then. He was the scouting director for the NBA,
mm-hmm.
like for all the teams. So he used to, you know, he used to tell
information
the recommendations, everybody. Yeah. And so he mentioned Scotty to Jerry. And so Jerry sends, I think it was Billy McKinney, you know, who played at Northwestern, take a look at this guy. So they go down there and they say, and this guy's really good. So Jerry goes to Scotty and tries to get him to skip the camps.
He doesn't want anyone else to see him.
Right. He tells him he'll buy him a ticket to Hawaii. And if he goes to Hawaii, you know, and hides out, we'll draft you.
Yeah.
And so this guy, he thinks he's nuts. You know, he doesn't know what this is about. Jerry tried the same thing. You know, he's tried that thing many times. He did it with Dan Marley. And Marley is another one, comes from Central Michigan, and he's like breaking out. And he goes to Marley when he's one of these camps, and when he's starting to go around to teams, and he says, if you stop working out for teams, we'll pick you. We have a third round pick we can pick you with. So Marley says to him, well, that's nice, I'm flattered, but if I go to all these teams, I'm going to be a first round pick.
Yeah.
Why would I wait to be a third round? The crowd said, I mean, he didn't understand. You know, he said, well, we can have it. So anyways, you know, but that was Jerry's dedication to his job and his team.
And so the secrecy stuff that you just talked about here, how he didn't want anybody else to look at some of the guys that he was looking at, this brings me to something else I wanted to ask you. I was, earlier today, I was reading the obituary that you wrote for Jerry yesterday on Bulls.com, which for anybody listening to this who hasn't read that, you should definitely go check it out. It's very, very, very good. But you told the story about how you reported that Jerry was scouting George Mrazan, and then he calls you up and basically tells you that like you've ruined the future of the Bulls because then you kind of tie it in with this whole other thing of like other team scouts knew how secretive Jerry liked to be, and so they would like tip you off about different guys that he was scouting. So were these guys that he actually was scouting, or were they just like tell you that he was scouting somebody just because
they would see him? Yeah, right, because you know, Jerry was so quirky, and, you know, other GMs knew they could, you know, they liked to just sort of, you know, I think, you know, that's part of probably what happened to Jerry growing up. You know, he was the victim of pranks, he was the victim of practical jokes, you know, he was a kid they probably made fun of a lot, you know, because he was trying to hang around with the jocks, and, you know, Jerry always tried too hard, you know, to sort of work his way in, and you know, you've seen that in situations where you know, we've all been through that. You want to be with, like, the cool guys, and you're working, you know, and they're going to make fun of you or don't want you around because, you know, you're really pushing yourself in there. And, you know, you can see where that probably happened with, you know, with Jerry some. So the thing with, you know, with Jerry, and I was to his credit, he always made a point. He always told his staff, you know, I don't want to see you with the other GMs. Don't run around with the pack. I don't want you sharing ideas with them, but more than that, I don't want you adopting their ideas. I want you to think for yourself. And so while all these other GMs were around scouting, and they still do it today, you know, you see them, it's all sitting together, they all coming up with the same list for the draft. And so he would never sit with any of those guys. In fact, you know, sometimes literally he'd be standing behind pillars. You know, they'd see him, you know, wearing his raincoat, you know, pretending he wasn't there or something. You know, because he's trying to find somebody. And even then, when there wasn't as nearly as much scouting, it was still hard to find somebody that nobody saw, nobody knew about. And so, you know, guys would call me occasionally and say, yeah, you're going to believe this. You know, Krause is here, and we know he's looking at this guy, because that's why we're all here looking at this one guy. So I just would drop those things in occasionally into my pre-draft stories. Yeah. And, you know, because I told somebody, I said, you know, they said, well, why did the media treat Jerry like that? I said, it's like President Trump. You know, if you call the people in the media, you know, jerks every day, you demean what they do and you accuse them of printing falsehoods, which Jerry always did with us, you're not going to get the benefit of the doubt. That's human nature. It doesn't work that way. But Jerry's thing was, anything you guys publish could endanger my opportunity to get this guy, or or help my team. So you're the enemy too.
Right. So it wasn't as much of a this is going to make me look bad if I
even no, it wasn't it's more
this is going to make me look too good and other people might start scouting this guy too.
Yeah, right. And so the Murison thing was he was furious with me. You know, and I put in like a joke. I said the guy Jerry, this guy's like 7'7" and can't hardly walk around. And, you know, he's a second round pick. You destroyed this franchise. We'll never recover from what you've done to us.
I think they ended up recovering okay.
But that was Jerry's passion for, right. You know, he was going to find somebody that nobody was going to find, and it was going to be a star. But, you know, that's the love and the hope of every scout. You know, it's like, what was it, Tom Greenway who found Mickey Mantle. And,
right.
And his whole career was made on, you know, he was the guy who found Mickey Mantle.
Now, how contentious was just the day-to-day life and structure of the Bulls between Krause, the coaching staff, the players? Because we covered NBA Now, this modern era, social media, and there's a lot of drama, but it's kind of fake and manufactured sometimes. It's not anywhere near what it used to be in the NBA at times. And I think those first three-peat Bulls really had drama all the time regarding contracts, legitimate hurt feelings, people kind of sniping behind each other's back. What was the environment like from, you kind of mentioned the media perspective with Krause, but from the players to the front office with management there, what was that atmosphere?
Well, just think about the 92 Olympics, what happened. Kukoc is in there.
Oh, yes.
The 92 Olympics, it was a big deal. This is the dream team,
yes.
Greatest team ever. And they get into the locker room before the game, Jordan and Pippen, you know, and they said, we're going to destroy this guy, Kukoc, and we're going to destroy him to get at Jerry Krause.
And they both volunteered to guard him and, like, dog him all game.
Well,
right?
because they knew that Kukoc was a guy that Krause had wanted for a long time and gone after and tried to convince to go to the NBA
but
for a long time.
But the point was, that was a brilliant move. That was one of the greatest things Krause did for the franchise. He finds this guy who I think is a Hall of Fame level player. I mean, this guy's, when he played in Europe, he won everything. He was by far the most dominant player in Europe. He handled the ball, shot, did everything. 6'10" guy who was, you know, could play like any guard. And so he finds this guy and he drafts him early. I mean, you know, the Spurs do this now. They're labeled geniuses, you know, brilliant. Back then, it because Scotty was upset with his contract, and Michael to an extent. And so they come up with this narrative that the Bulls care more about Tony Kukoc, you know, this guy, than they do about us. I mean, Jordan and Pippen couldn't have been more wrong, but it didn't matter because they were Jordan and Pippen.
Right.
Now, they had just won a title. And so, you know, just by you know, comparison. Well, if Jordan and Pippen are mad, it must be, you know, he must be doing the wrong thing. So the community is angry with this, you know, with Krause too. And so to take it to that level, to go to the Olympics, and then to try to embarrass this poor kid, you know, Kukoc took it great, you know, and it never bothered him and fit in great and you know, but those guys, I remember that game, how angry they were, and Pippen is up on him. And it's the best defender in the league, maybe one of the best in the history of the game. and he's all over him, you know. I mean, this is after they shut down Magic Johnson in the finals the year before. And then they're taking turns. Now Jordan comes in and is bumping him and pushing him. And so, just, you know, that's just an indication of what went on. But the reason it went on, you know, like that is, and the reason it sort of focused on, well, focused on Jerry because he was the GM. He was the only one who dealt with the players, essentially. And the GM, you know, has to fall on the sword for the owner, you know, finances, whatever, contracts. But you mentioned before, you know, one of Krause's, to me, the move was the trade of Juwan Oldham. He was a seven-footer shot blocker. I think he went on either not maybe the Bulls, maybe the next year. He led the league in shot blocks one year. A decent player, not great. But he was one of the ones Jerry wants to get rid of. And gets a future first-round pick from the Knicks. On the 87 draft, he's able to flip that with Seattle to move up and get Pippen. So that's where the Pippen pick comes from, this Juwan Oldham thing. But Jordan is furious at the time. He's trying to win. You know, he's being compared to Magic and Mike and Larry already and saying, yeah, you're a good scorer, but you can't win any games. And you know, he's going, well, he's playing with Parrish and McHale. The other guy's playing with Kareem and Worthy. You know, not only do I have nothing, but the few guys I got, you're giving away for draft picks in the future. So Jordan is furious about all this. And so, you know, we're on trips all the time, and they're taunting him, and they're yelling at him, and Pippen, you know, after he gets his deal, and probably part of it was spoiled as is, even like how much you can be spoiled in a 10-room, in a 2-room house with 10 people. But, you know, last baby of the family kind of thing. So he was upset about his contract. And the stuff that these guys would say was amazing. I remember one time we were in Boston, and Pippen.
What year was this?
This would have been about 89, right? Somewhere around 89, 90. It was Phil's first year. And so we're in Boston, and something happened with the guy. They lost the game or something, and something with Krause. So Pippen sat, you know, after the game, Scotty would always do this, you know, sort of conversationally. You know, Jerry Krause has ruined the Bulls. We're never going to win anything because of Jerry Krause. He's the worst guy in the NBA. You know, he just goes on this rant about Krause and the Bulls and everything's a disaster. And then so we get back the next day, you know, it was no charter. We flew back. And so we come into practice the next day, and Phil goes, and it's like media all over, you know, all the guys who don't travel now are there, TV and everything. And Scotty walks in and goes, why is everybody here? What's going on? Has something happened? And Phil goes, well, Scotty, it's what you said last night. He said, what I said?
Like, they didn't even think it was a big deal.
Yeah, right. It was no big deal to him because they're out ripping this guy all the time, you know, because between his, you know, Chase and Cooker, things he was doing for the organization, the right thing. Now some of it happened with Jordan. You know, that was the other thing, too, with Jordan's foot injury.
Right.
He breaks his foot, third game of the season, leaves, goes home, you know, goes to North Carolina. Unbeknownst to the Bulls, he's playing pickup basketball, like, after 4 weeks. So the doctors tell him, they said there's a chance that if he breaks it again, his career is over. You know, it was a 10% chance, I think they told him. And they shouldn't have told him the percent. You know, so Michael, being the gambler, says, I'll take that risk. You know, it's only 10%. You know, I got 90% for me. And so they get on a conference. Anyway, Krause is the heavy in that and comes out as you can't play. And then anyway, they settle. They give him this time limit. You know, you can play 14 minutes, 16 minutes.
Yeah.
It's a great tradition in Bulls history.
That's
true. You know, minute limitations. Which actually comes down and gets Stan Albeck fired. Because Michael's furious. You know, he's fine. He comes back and he would score like, you know, 30 points in 18 minutes. They take him out of the game. So then there's this game late. It's right at the end of the season. It's like the next to the last game or something, or last game. And so Stan Albeck is the coach that year. And he's, as coaches would be, sympathetic with Michael. And so they get to like, right at the end, Michael's time limit comes up. They were down like 18 points to Indiana.
Yeah.
They come all the way back. You know, Michael's scoring one basket after the next. And they
reach the restriction.
They get to like within a point. Or tied right within a point. And they reach the restriction with like 50 seconds left or something. So Albeck pulls him out of the game.
Okay.
You know, like a screw you to Matt to Kras. And Michael's going berserk, you know.
I imagine.
Yeah. And so Paxton comes in, hits a shot, wins the game.
Okay.
Saves the game. But then Michael, after the game, goes off on Kras, you know, that, you know. And anyway, and that gets Stan fired because, you know, he sort of showed them up on
right.
that, you know. But so this kind of dynamic is going on all the time. There's chaos, you know, and then, you know, Phil gets in, and one of the things Phil does, you know, in his little way of doing things is, well, we have to have some way to bond the team. What could we bond again? So
during the first kind of real.
Yeah. So during the first year, he comes up with all the second year comes up with all these things about, well, you know, you're upset with Kras about this. So Phil kind of uses that.
He was just like, this is something we can all agree on. Like we all hate this guy.
It's so like management too, you know, ownership, whatever. They're screwing us on this. You know, Michael, they're screwing you on this guy with your contract. And so, you know, he becomes the heavy in a lot of respects, you know, for that championship team. And then, you know, and so Michael and Scotty are criticizing him, and, you know, you can't win that battle. I learned that, too, you know, with the Jordan rules.
Did Kras take that? How did he take that?
Well, what hurt him then is because, you know, he was still the boss.
Yeah.
You know, so he still had, you know, he could go wherever he wanted. He had free reign. So, you know, he would start hanging around the players, you know, and that's where the taunting would start. You know, he would go in, and when they were getting a massage, he would get a massage.
Kind of a sanctuary of sorts.
Right.
For him.
So he'd start going around, you know, and so, you know, things like that were, you know, but he, I always felt sort of badly because, you know, he really wanted to be accepted by the players. And the players, you know, they don't, and you really, as an executive, have to have your distance with the players, because, you know, you're going to have to make tough decisions. You're going to trade them, you know, not give them the contract they want or whatever. And you know, Jerry so loved the players, you know, so, you know, really, guys later in his, you know, he'd bring back guys like Herbert Parrish, who they prevented him from drafting in 76. He ends up bringing him back to one of the Bulls championship teams. And Brent Barry, we loved, you know, in the draft and missed out on. He signs as his first free agent, you know, after Jordan leaves. And so
Steve Kerr is another guy that he wanted early on, right? And then,
yeah, you know, Steve kind of actually, Steve ends up he called them, you know, to ask if, like, sort of off a tryout, you know, you know, he sort of invited himself, you know, and he sort of measured. He saw Paxson, you know, was knee problems, and, you know, was probably toward the end of his career, and, you know, thought he could just, you know, find the space. Ends up coming, you know, Michael retires. You know, the first time, you know, so, you know, I mean, Jerry probably brought some of that stuff on himself by hanging around, you know, around the players, trying to be one of the guys, you know, trying to sort of bond with the players a little bit.
Do you think Michael and Scotty and the players had a greater appreciation for him after it was all over, as they aged? Did they ever tell him thank you?
Yes, they did. They did. They grudgingly admitted years later, you know, afterwards, that Kras had done a good job, that he had put these pieces together. Michael, in fact, I know Michael told Jerry Reinsdorf, I don't know if he told Kras directly, but he told Jerry Reinsdorf that, you know, running a team is much harder than he ever imagined. And the things that Jerry Kras did, you know, were really good. I don't know if he ever said that to Jerry. I think Reinsdorf told Jerry that. But I think, you know, in one of the owners' meetings when they were together, because they would, Charlotte and Chicago, they were sitting, you know, that's the way they sit in these Board of Governors meetings, that Jerry and Michael would always be together. And so I know, you know, Jerry once told me that Michael had expressed to him that, you know, I don't know, he probably regretted somehow he treated him too, but, you know, that was Michael's way. He treated everybody like that. It wasn't just Jerry, you know, when he called, you know, when he called him crumbs and made fun of that. You know, he was making fun of Horace too. You know, he would take his food away on the plane and say, you don't play well enough, you're going to get to eat.
Where did the crumbs nickname come from?
It came from, because when they were traveling around and they were always stopping at donut shops, you know. There was this big donut. If you guys have ever been in L.A., you know, the big donut shop in L.A. When you're driving over from the airport,
heard of it.
There's this right along the highway, there's this donut shop that got like an 80-foot donut.
Oh, man.
So they would drive past it, and Jordan, you know, was such a needler, and he would yell, "Hey, we got to stop there. Got Jerry's donut there." You know, stuff like that. You know, so they were relentless needlers, but they did that to did it to everybody. You know, it was, I mean, that's the way, you know, players are, young people are, but you know, they would take advantage of Jerry because Jerry wasn't somebody who was good with a quip. You know, wasn't able to fence with them verbally like they did, and you know, and that was just the nature of who he was. You know, a scout, used to a solitary life, detail oriented. Yeah, I remember, you know, the story when Cliff Ray, who they found, you know, Jerry, that was Jerry's pick, with a third round pick, and when he came to the Bulls and met Jerry, he recognized him and he said, "Are you the guy that's been following me around campus all these last months?"
He recognized him because
because Jerry in his raincoat would be walking around, you know, like some, you know, like some detective, because he wanted to see was he going to class, what was his personal habits, you know. So you know, Jerry would check every little box, you know, and he would want to do it himself.
We'll get to wrapping it up here with you, but maybe get you out of here on this one. He is a finalist for the Hall of Fame in the contributor category. Do you think Jerry Krause is going to get in the Hall of Fame? And just what's his legacy, I guess, here in Chicago, just wrapped up in one there?
Well, unfortunately, you know, he'll get in the Hall of Fame. Not unfortunately get in the Hall of Fame, but unfortunately he won't,
too late,
you know, get to enjoy it. I think he has been appreciated here in Chicago. Look, there's a banner, as you know.
There is.
I don't know of another arena in the league that has a banner for, you know, an executive. Red Auerbach and Jerry West were coaches. I mean, Jerry West was a player. I mean, yeah. Pat Riley and Red Auerbach, you know, were coaches. You know, so he's honored that way. He was two-time NBA executive in the year.
Yeah.
So, you know, you know, I know there's a narrative about he's unappreciated, but I think he has been appreciated. You know, it's hard to be appreciated enough, you know,
in the moment, maybe.
Yeah, when the other guys being appreciated are a guy who's viewed as the greatest player in the history of the game, a guy who is a top 50 player, he's considered maybe the best defensive player in the game, and a coach who has the most championships of everybody in the history of the game. Now,
and the other part of it is he also wasn't really a guy that played the political game in terms of, because you know, a big part of it, I was listening to Woj's podcast. I was re-listening to it yesterday, where he had him on this from a couple months ago, and he was basically telling the story of how, like, the reason that he's not in the Hall of Fame was because he was on the committee to select who's in the Hall of Fame originally, and then he boycotted it one year because Tex Winter wasn't on the ballot, and since then he kind of fell out of favor with the decision makers.
That is one of the reasons, and right, it wasn't so much that he boycotted the committee, but he quit the committee, and they have a lot of different committees.
Well, but there was also the story about how, you know, Jordan calls him out in his Hall of Fame acceptance speech for not being there, and the reason he wasn't there for real was because he said he wasn't going to go to any of these until Tex Winter got inducted.
Right.
So it was a long-running thing for him.
Right, but what he did was he blasted the Hall of Fame to the media when he got out.
Right.
You know, it's a bunch of bums, and, you know, because he was so, you know, dedicated to Tex. And again, it was not the political thing to do. You
know, so they just kind of blackballed him because of that.
I don't think they blackballed them, is that there was no enthusiasm for... And the other thing is that there are not... You know, there's no category for executives, per se, in the Hall of Fame. There's players, and there's coaches. There's three. Player, and they've added some more now. But generally, there was always players, one category, coaches, and contributors. And you could put executives in there, but there really weren't hardly any. And so... You know, there wasn't some sort of groundswell because there was essentially no other executives. But so that was one of the reasons, I think. I mean, I don't know. But, you know, if you come out and you tell somebody they're dirt, then they're not going to fall over themselves to honor you at their house.
Right.
The other thing was he spent half his career in baseball. You know,
that's
and
true.
So basketball people said, and he's often would say that he was really a baseball guy. You know, he loved scouting, he loved baseball. That was his true love. So, you know, and there have been guys who were professional baseball players and professional basketball players in the Hall of Fame. But he often made the point that, you know, baseball is who I am. And so, you know, some of the voters said, well, you know, maybe he should be in a baseball Hall of Fame.
Didn't stop Jerry Reinsdorf from getting in last year.
Right. Eventually did get in. Right. And so, again, I think Krause will get in. I think it'll be either this year or next year.
I mean, to me, it's just such a no-brainer. The guy who, I mean, yes, he did inherit Michael Jordan, but he did the Scottie Pippen trade, drafted Horace Grant, did the Dennis Rodman trade later on to retool. Yeah. The greatest, you can say, you know, the 80s Lakers or Celtics or the Bill Russell era Celtics or whoever, and say, like, among the greatest teams of all time. The 90s Bulls were among the greatest runs of all time in the history of the sport, and he was the guy who built those teams. Like, to me, it's such a no-brainer that he should be in the Hall of Fame.
Well, and there's been more of a outpouring by the media. And that's another thing, too. I mean, he was, for a long time, very unpopular in the media. You know, most of these national media guys he had had issues with over the years, for one thing or another. And that's gone away. You know, I saw NBA.com listed where they had the top 10...
Execs?
Top 10 people who were overlooked for the Hall of Fame. Okay. And I just did number one. And so that was like a year ago. You know, and so the point was there's been this groundswell developing to the point where, you know, I think I don't know exactly when the vote, you know, when this one he was voted in. You know, during the All-Star break, they announced
the
finalists and things, but he wasn't in that category. He was like what they call a direct elect thing now, that it would be directly announced. You know, and there's a period of waiting time earlier before they'll tell. So I don't know if they told somebody else, you know, or they're doing it now. And so, like I said, I thought he would get in this year before, you know, when we were in February. When I always go to that Hall of Fame announcement thing, and when we were there, I got a feel that he was going to get in this time, but I think he will get in. Unfortunately, you know, he died before that, and that's unfortunate because he really wanted that. He got to go to Texas. You know, Texas did get in, and so
it's too bad he's not going to be there, and his family is. He's not going to be right. to be there to, you know, give the acceptance speech and be
right.
there with, you know, all the other people and, you know, kind of see that appreciation firsthand. But
but look, you know, by the time Tex got in, you know, he couldn't give his speech. You know, he had Alzheimer's,
mm-hmm.
and so his, you know, he had a son-in-law, I think, give a speech for him.
Certainly a Bulls legend, Jerry Krause was. Obviously a little bit complicated of a legacy. That's what you're best at, though. It's not always black and white, Sam. Right? It's
right.
a lot of gray. And
it's all gray.
You've been covering that for years and years, as well as anyone. And we greatly appreciate you joining the podcast.
Yeah, this was
and
fantastic.
And we're going to have you back on just to tell Michael Jordan.
We could do this.
Was this on?
Yeah, it was the whole time.
Okay,
right. Yeah, and we're not big into editing stuff, so
we usually just for reference, most of our podcasts are like between 20 and 30 minutes. This one's gone for 50. We could do this for days.
It's story time with Sam.
All right, we'll have to do that at some point. Thanks so much for doing this, Sam.